The Politics Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
Welcome to the Radio Reverb Politics Show. It's a show in two halves this month. First, we will be joined by satirist, comedian, journalist and political activist Mark Thomas. While later, I'm joined in the studio by two local journalists who will be giving their views on the highs and lows of 2017. But first, Mark, what do you make of the bizarre political situation?
It is bizarre, that's first of all. We're living under a kind of Game of Thrones situation where actually no one is righteously in control. No one's actually rightly got their hands on the levers of power. No one is steering in any kind of rational sense. And there is a strong possibility that dragons will invade and attack us. What we have got is a Tory party, which at best, the Tory party is essentially a bag of snakes.
You don't feel strongly about it then.
Well, you know, you've asked me my opinion. The Tory party are essentially a posh bag of snakes that just want to attack each other. And at various points, they are persuaded to sort of like not do that because someone's more powerful than them and they actually stand, there are kind of power games and tactics that can be enacted to keep people under control. At the moment, the Tory party is in full bag of snake attack mode.
I mean, it must be devastating for people whose jobs and livelihoods and futures
It's devastating for people whose livelihoods. It's devastating for the woman who's in Iran because Boris Johnson opened his mouth and she's got 5 years added to her sentence. You know, it's devastating for all sorts of things. It's devastating because you've got austerity and you've got, you actually have life expectancy in this country going down. Right now, this is a real new thing. Life expectancy has been improving and now it starts to go down. This is austerity. You know, if you talk to people in NHS and talk to people in frontline services, like A&E, they're actually become the stopgap for failures in welfare and social policy. So people are presented with drug, alcohol, homelessness issues, mental health issues, gang issues. These are all things that are part of welfare and social policy, which are failing.
I mean, is there any, your stock in trade is to take these issues and make satire out of it. Are we beyond satire in the current situation?
No, I mean, this point is, I don't know whether we're beyond satire or whether satire is now entering a stage of gestalt screaming. I don't know.
Yes, I mean, it is just, sometimes you just rub your eyes and you can't believe what you're reading or hearing.
Well, you get two ministers who resign, another bloke who's gone because, he asked his secretary to go and buy sex toys. You've got Theresa May turning up at Dacre's birthday party. You've got absolute bloody chaos. This woman in Iran and Johnson opening his gob. You've got a whole wealth of things happening.
But it does.
Which are just insane.
It is a shame.
We don't know if there's going to be a border with Ireland and Northern Ireland. Is there going to be a border there? Is the pound going to fall further? Is the inflation going to rise? Are wages going to go down? How are we going to get any tax receipts? What are we going to do about bloody offshore bankers? All this kind of stuff.
It's not funny at all, really.
It isn't, but we are living in a world of chaos. And so my shows absolutely resolutely resemble that now. So I ask people for their forecasts of the future, and then we just kind of write, we discuss what we think is going to happen, and the show has become this chaotic collective expression of disbelief.
And because of this Alice in Wonderland scenario that we seem to be living through, take bets on which things might come to fruition.
Yeah.
What are the front runners at the moment at the bookies with some of the things that have come out of your shows?
Well, May to go. She'll go. People are saying that she'll go in 2018. We've got the odds on that. Just nobody knows. Nobody actually knows. So the odds on that aren't great. They're about 5 to 6 at the moment for her to go next year. I think what she has shown is a determination to try and stay on, and you've seen that. She's shown this determination, whether it is dealing with Priti Patel or Fallon, or whether it is dealing with
suddenly finding a billion quid for the DUP.
Yeah, or finding that money for the DUP. So I think, you know, you never know. It's events, dear boy. Events, you know, as the quote says, things happen. Yeah. And actually, you need six by-election wins for Corbyn turnarounds, and bang, you've got a different government.
But do you think the only thing that's actually holding the government together is the fear of a Corbyn government?
The only thing holding the government together is fear of a Corbyn government. Certainly, that's one of the factors. And the other factor is the battle for Brexit.
But Brexit has a time limit, doesn't it? It comes to an end in March 2019. And
it doesn't. That's when it starts.
Yes, well...
That's not when things end. Well, it kind of is. It's the start of the end.
But we've got, as we're recording this interview, we've got David Davis offering a vote in Parliament on a take-it-or-leave-it basis and is suggesting, oh, no, this is genuine and democratic choice. But is it? I mean, I can't
Of course
see
it's not. It's not democratic choice if it's kind of like, OK, if you don't approve of this, then it's no deal. That's not a democratic choice. That's a gun to your head.
I mean, are there any politicians, because everything we've been talking about suggests that the reputation of politicians is at an all-time low. I mean, you couldn't think it could sink any further. But are there any stand-up politicians currently Parliament?
I think there are, actually. And I think there have been a number of stand-up politicians. Obviously, Caroline Lucas has been absolutely amazing. Tommy Shepherd for the SNP has been really good, so has Mary Black. I think Corbyn's absolutely marvellous.
I think he's grown in strength, I think.
It's absolutely incredible that he's grown in strength and stature. And actually, people now, you see, you said, you know, are the Tories frightened of a Corbyn government? Yes, they are. And they weren't. They weren't 6 months ago.
Well, that was...
He has grown and grown and grown, and actually he got the youth vote out, and he got people out who were absolutely furious at the way austerity has been going. And so I think there's people in the Labour Party who are really interesting, especially there are young women there who are doing a really amazing job, whether it's, I think Angela Rayner's really great, I think Piddock's really good. So, you know, there's interesting people there.
Yes, I mean, locally here, there is an internal struggle going on within the local Labour Party, which I think is probably being replicated around the country.
Well, there is a marvellous thing that Nye Bevin once said, that the right wing of the Labour Party would rather lose the Labour Party than lose control. And I think he's probably right.
Well, it's sad, really, because we have Momentum members, which has, as you say, attracted huge interests in politics and literally... a galvanised youth interest in politics. And they are getting into good places within the local constituency parties, and they are getting into a position, I understand, where they will be able to pick candidates for local elections and possibly parliamentary elections too.
Great.
And
I mean, I think what you want is you want actually more democratic control. You want a link between people and their politicians that goes beyond the kind of perfunctory kind of once every so many years everyone turns up to vote and then just go away.
Bottom-up politics.
I think it's really exciting that, you know, if you've got a chance for people to just really get stuck in and say this is what we want, to develop policy and to actually get ideas from the ground up. That's really exciting.
Yes, and be answerable.
Grassroots democracy is really thrilling.
And be answerable to the people who actually elected them and expect them to serve them.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, where the whole caboodle could come undone is where those people living in their city towers start manipulating the markets and creating financial chaos, which has happened before under Labour administrations. I mean, do you think that might be the downfall of a Corbyn government if it came to be?
I don't know. I wouldn't like to say, I really don't know.
I mean, they exercise extraordinary power and they seem to be hidden power, and often what comes with that is that their own wealth is hidden offshore, as we've discovered.
In terms of offshore money, you know, in terms of the city taking stuff out of the country, I mean, that's an issue. And McDonald starts to address it when he talked about, you know, you have to prepare for a run on the pound. And I think it's quite brave of him to sort of like jump in and go, we have to do this. What's interesting is at this point you go, okay, if that's sort of like, you know, on you know, that's possibly something that could happen. There is also, I think, a groundswell movement of people who are really, you know, just absolutely pissed off with the offshore tax havens. And actually, there's a growing move to just go, okay, we have to get these under control.
And so many of them are British offshore islands, which
is shameful. Indeed they are, which means we have a chance for influencing and stopping them.
Well, not well.
And that's amazing.
Not so, while so many powerful backers of political parties have their dosh stashed away there, I suspect.
Yeah, those are the vested interests. That's the establishment. That's who we're fighting.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the gig, is how do we actually win round people? You know, the Daily Mail is offshore, so is the Daily Express, so is the, you know, sections of the Guardian are offshore. You know, the Murdoch famously is offshore. You know, the press is offshore. So you're fighting against the press. You're fighting against, you know, financial interests. You know, Arron Banks and all the Brexiteers, or, you know, Mogg and all those people who have got offshore links. You know, that's really, you know, this is the establishment. The Queen, you know, has got offshore links. Involved in Bright House, you know, which is just absolutely sort of the most despicable, poor-hating company and exploiting people. You know, and the Queen's involved, you know, and she's virtually sort of like, you know, her and Philip will probably be going around on the horse and cart doing repossessions. The point is that's the establishment. That's who you're fighting. That's the battle.
Well, it seems a dismal prospect in place, and especially when you have some pretty awful things going on around the world as well, and some pretty disappointing crisis hitting the headlines. What's going on in Myanmar is so disappointing to many people here in this country, especially in Brighton and Hove, where Aung San Suu Kyi was a guest.
I know,
director.
I'm actually, you know, the number of bloody benefit gigs I did to get her released, and now I'm thinking, no, sorry, I'm going to do one to get her jailed.
Well,
she's going to be the only, in fact, Aung San Suu Kyi is going to be the only political leader that I will have done a benefit gig to get her released and in prison.
Well, I wonder whether she is just hostage to the military, and the democratic vote there was window dressing, and she is powerless to act.
Possibly. However, there's no excuse for genocide. You can't just stand around and just go, ah, well, you know, it's politics.
I mean, I was shocked when she used the words of Donald Trump has made famous now of fake news. I mean, it was very, very disappointing. And I can understand why Bob Geldof has asked for his name to be taken off the roll of honour in Dublin.
But, you know, Bob Geldof, I wouldn't use him as a weather vane for any particular moral.
Yes. Well, look, this is all very disappointing stuff. And I think you've been told that we have our Desert Island Disc moment in this show, just to lighten the mood a bit. And I wonder whether you'd like to just tell listeners what your choice of music is to break up all this gloom before we all cut our throats.
It is Frankie Wilson and Do I Love You, and it's one of the great Northern Soul classics, and it's an absolute beautiful song. And actually, what always makes me feel excited and always makes me feel optimistic is actually the kindness that we show each other that is inherently within us. And given half the chance, the human race has got a chance to be a magnificent, magnificent species of interwoven love.
Ah, on that uplifting note, let's fade in. Do I Love You? Thank you very much for talking to us.
That's a pleasure.
Well, now joining in the studio with me are two of Brighton's leading journalists, the lovely Andrew Kay, who looks a delight in his pink and cerise ensemble, and Frank Leduc, both latest TV and latest magazines in one way or another, and also Brighton Hove News. But Frank and, dare I mention it, the Daily Mail.
Fake news.
Fake news, that's all right. So I've asked you to come in to follow that fantastic interview with Mark Thomas to give us your reflections on the year that's just passed for this edition of Radio Reverb's politics show. So Frank, kick off.
Well, I think you could have asked us in before, Mark, if you don't mind. Then at least you could have ended the show on a high, but here we go, let's try. I think the event of the year, politically anyway, was the general election. It seems a lifetime ago now, but I just think that the Tories went into it with a commanding poll lead, comfortably expecting a decent working majority, and then they launched their manifesto. And everyone had written off Jeremy Corbyn, including his own party. His parliamentary colleagues had been trying to oust him. And he got their... I know it wasn't a win, although they seemed to be treating it like one, but they got their best result for 12 years.
It was a dignified loss.
It was a very British defeat. And, of course, everyone was having a go at him. And nobody... We like the underdog in this country, regardless of our politics. And I think people felt sorry for him, actually.
But dangerously, the consequence of Theresa May going with such high hopes and coming away with such a poor performance, as A, she's having to struggle to hold on to her job, but she's then had to sup with the devil, and she's gone into bed with the Ulster Unionists, the DUP, and now as we come into the thick of the Brexit negotiations, Ireland is top of the agenda, and of course she is stymied about what she can do with her DUP colleagues.
Well, she has inherited something of a poison chalice with this, hasn't she? I mean, who would want to be in her position? I can't help suspecting that she actually didn't really want to win.
Well, but I mean, it's had many consequences here. And of course, we saw in the general election, of course, when we were chatting before the show about the years, Frank had reminded me the general election, and like you, I guess I've completely pushed it out of my brain. And one of the consequences locally here was we saw our three MPs increase their majorities.
Two of them
increased their majorities massively. And we saw the demise of the only Tory in Brighton and Hove, with the rise of a Corbynista, Lloyd Russell Moyle, in the east of the city. And I guess Peter Kyle with now one of the safest Labour seats in the country.
We are the most wonderful bubble of socialism down here, aren't we?
It is. It's quite interesting. And I guess there was also the added interest in that locally the Lib Dems decided not to stand against Peter Kyle in Hove, and the Greens decided not to contest Kemp Town, where Lloyd was triumphant, which was quite an interesting move and had some consequences because not everyone in the Green Party agreed with Caroline Lucas's idea. So no doubt she is having to bear the consequences of that, even though many think she still does walk on water. Yeah.
Well, both she and Peter Carl increased their majorities quite comfortably. And Lloyd, Lloyd Russell Moyle was elected with quite an astonishing majority, actually. And again, I think what you saw locally was a lot of things had bubbled up for a while, and all the Corbynistas in the city tended to go and work and support Lloyd. And not all, but many of them, regardless of where in Brighton and Hove they came from. And many of the people who were more at the other end of the Labour Party went and supported Peter in his efforts.
Yeah.
And I don't think either of those guys took anything for granted.
No, although I did comment to another leading Labour person in Hove that Peter had all but airbrushed the Labour Party out of his literature. You needed a magnifying glass to make sure which party he supported.
And it's a little unkind. I know what you mean. But he,
I think it's a little harsh too.
But he, I think he did get the reverse of a double whammy. I.e., if you're not Labour, it's safe to vote for me because I'm not a Corbynite. And if you are Labour, I'm the only show in town. Yeah. You know.
But I mean, it's significant to me that Lord Bassam, who was no great fan of Jeremy Corbyn, did tell me in another interview that I did, and he was part of the show. That he had to eat large dollops of humble pie. And I suspect quite a few parliamentary party had to do that as well. But, you know, it's a long day in politics
when something doesn't happen. Watch and wait with this one.
I don't think we should also forget the amazing triumph in failure that Sophie Cook achieved in Shoreham. West Worthing, where she absolutely trounced.
More than 20,000 votes. She's now, of course, the presenter on Radio Reverb.
But from the position, I know Sophie will forgive me for describing her as the underdog, but really, from nowhere to turn around that part of the electorate to that extent was an amazing achievement.
In true blue Worthing.
Absolutely. Mm.
I mean, now we've talked about Sophie, let's just talk about some of the highlights in the LGBT year, Andrew.
Well, the major highlight has to be that it's the 50th anniversary of the partial repeal of homosexuality, the decriminalisation of homosexuality, which brought up all sorts of interesting topics, and one of which was, I think, the fact that a lot of women saw this as being rather a male-dominated celebration. And I think the fault here isn't with the men, but the truth is that because at that point lesbianism wasn't illegal in any sense, that we have sidelined the issues that women have, LGBTQI, whatever women have, because of that, and there is a lack of understanding that they, because it wasn't illegal, they weren't in any way being oppressed. But of course they were being oppressed, and the legality issue here actually clouds the issue completely, because they had the same issues to deal with in modern society.
Indeed.
And I think that's what's happened.
And of course the other big news on the LGBT front was there was this I don't know what to call it, a referendum, plebiscite,
it was a vote of opinion, support
opinion poll in Australia.
Well, the result was spectacular. I mean, spectacular in favour of allowing legalising marriage in Australia. The great news this week is that the government have actually said that they are not going to allow Parliament to go into recession for Christmas until it's resolved, and they've passed it.
Well, let's hope people who are against it don't block it.
Well, the awful thing is that these people who are against it, as you say, are saying that they have between 60 and 100 issues that they're going to present to block it. Well, you know, grow up. Grow up. That's all you have to say to these people. What are they frightened of? Are they frightened of allowing men to marry men and women to marry women?
It's going to be compulsory.
On what basis? I mean, you know, you don't have to join in. You don't have to come and play. You don't have to be a part of that society. And I promise you, gay men and gay women are not going to knock on their straight neighbours' doors and say, we're married and you now have to become our best friends.
Yes, I mean, there is some...
So there's no impact.
There's a degree of irrationality that seems to raise its head every time there's an LGBT issue hitting the headlines for one reason or another.
Can I bring us closer to home on this one?
Yes, please.
I was just to say, with Pride here, because we've got, again, it's sort of, it's been going quite a while locally now, and for many years it was a troubled organisation financially in terms of getting it going every year. And Geoffrey, you and I lived through this with different hats on at different times. And I mean, you mentioned this before we went on air, but the success of the Rainbow Fund, for example, and
well, £110,000 raised for local LGBT charities is phenomenal.
And there's more money going to non-LGBT charities. It's going to be dialed out this evening at a meeting. The evening we're recording this at a meeting of the trustees for that as well. So, you know, it's gone from being a financial basket case to being, you know, not just a great event on its day, but actually a great fundraiser for good causes.
And there were many people who fought against the notion of barring off the park and charging for people to get in. But financially...
It was unsustainable if you didn't. Yeah. I think the real issue with Pride, and I think it's in a better position now in Brighton than it has been for a long time. I can remember the first Pride I went on, which was back in the, you know, the late 17th century, I think. And it was a protest march, and we walked through Westminster and we barracked 10 Downing Street, and we had a really good time, but it was a protest march. We were fighting for equality. Now, over the years, with increased levels of equality, what we've seen is a lack of campaigning and a sort of complacency within the LGBT community about these things. And what it still needs to be is a protest march. It needs to be a demonstration as well as a celebration. And the two things aren't mutually exclusive. You can go out and celebrate your pride and at the same time say, we are proud. We're proud of where we are. We're proud of what we've achieved in the UK. But we are really still very aware of the massive inequalities globally. And there are countries in this world where homosexuality is punishable by death.
And shamefully, many of those Commonwealth countries.
Many of them are parts of the Commonwealth. And what are we doing about this? So, you know, we need to raise our hands and start saying, yeah, fantastic. You know, it's 50 years on. It's great. We can get married. We can do pretty much what we want. But there are still major issues that need to be dealt with.
And we shouldn't actually think that it's job done in this country.
Certainly isn't.
If you speak to Billy at the LGBT Safety Forum, Community Safety Forum, they have to deal with a desperate number of calls on a regular basis.
Well, Billy Lewis and the Safety Forum have actually received quite, I think, the largest piece of funding from the Rainbow Fund, and quite deservedly so. I mean, they are the most tireless group of men and women who are there to support people who are still suffering inequality because of their sexuality.
As I always say when we talk about these things, Andrew, tolerance is often just surface deep, just a little bit down, and it allows people to come out with the most appalling...
Straight talk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think on that note, we're going to take a short break, a short musical break. Now, I have warned you in advance, and I turn to you, Andrew, first, because I know you've had time to sleep on this.
Well, it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult.
And you promised me that it wasn't going to be the Wagner Ring Cycle, or the full Ring Cycle.
Well, I did initially choose a beautiful Bach cantata that I absolutely love, but it's 8 minutes long, and I think that's rather too long, and I wouldn't want it to be played in a shortened version.
No.
And then I thought of my favourite pop song from being a teenager. But on the way in here, they thought this morning, actually, I'd really like David Bowie, John, I'm Only Dancing.
OK, well, let's pause for a moment and listen to that amazing song from an amazing singer who didn't die so long ago. And then we'll come back and take up this conversation again. Well, welcome back. Now, Frank, the other issues, we've talked about a couple of the major issues that in the year. The NHS has never been off the agenda locally or nationally, come to that. We've had GP surgeries closing. We've got a trust that is looking like a building site and is going to be like that for another 9 or so years and is still in special measures.
We had the K-Performer ambulance saga where the patient transport services seemed to fell apart as well,
briefly,
but that's been sort of resolved, I think, and seems to be...
A total failure of commissioning, in my view.
Oh, no, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Only
it's a disaster.
And commissioners who are only interested in the lowest bid and then... getting a service that bites them in the bum as a consequence.
I'm not entirely unsympathetic because they're under such enormous pressure from above to cut costs and to look at and to use commissioning and contracting out tenders as a way of saving money that I think this is sometimes an inevitable consequence. And I think that our health commissioners also aren't particularly experienced at commissioning and contracts, to be honest. I really don't think they are compared with some of the private sector organisations they deal with. So it's no surprise sometimes if they seem as though they've been stiffed over.
Yeah, but I mean, it is slightly worrying that locally we've got about 30,000 people who have been affected by their local surgeries closing down, and then being for- and one or two of them, you know, quite a few people have been forced to go to new surgeries on two
more
occasions.
Than one, yeah. No, absolutely. And I don't think we've seen the end of this yet. I mean, I think we've had a little hiatus. One's just closed in at the end of September this year, and I think that makes about seven or eight now. And I wouldn't be surprised if more go yet. We've got a surprisingly high number of GPs who are sort of 50 plus, and they don't all want to work till full retirement age, and nor do they need to, they don't have to financially compared with some people. So I think we're going to see more of this, and possibly some pharmacies as well.
Well, I can talk from personal experience. My own surgery closed because one of the senior partners was decided to have, you know, he was had enough after a number of years, and the other one wanted to spend more time with his motorcycle, and told me that he was fed up with top-down management of the NHS, and he felt that he could do better by being a locum and having more time to tour around on his motorcycle collection.
I've spoken to a friend who's a GP, and he has actually left the surgery he was at and is doing work as a locum. And he said it's because of the administrative pressure. Yeah. And actually, he trained to be a doctor because he wanted to care for people.
Yeah.
And actually, all he seemed to be doing was caring for numbers. Mm. And it's not the same thing. Yeah. And I found the same when I was teaching, when I was a lecturer in education. And I valued my hours working with students and talking to students about art and design. But it, increasingly, all I was doing was ticking boxes and filling in forms and reading enormous documents that were coming out of what I considered to be an administratively heavy organisation.
Yes, I mean, we do seem to have turned more and more over 2017 into a target-driven society. And you mentioned education; it's never more so than in the local secondary schools here. They are fighting their corner, and quite unusual to see banners outside the gates of every school in the city talking about the amount of money that's been taken away from local education in Brighton and Hove. And I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, again, before we came on air at the start, you were talking about austerity and the age of austerity. And I think one thing that links quite a few of the things that we've spoken about in the public sector are the sort of they're related to the austerity policies that came in after the financial crisis. And I think, you know, probably the big exception to that is the work going on at the Royal Sussex, which is going to be for the next 9 or 10 years, a huge capital investment. It's been put off for years. But the one bit of good news lately, I think, in the health service is that a trust that's currently in special measures, that has been in special measures with a new board, still going to have loads of problems because it's a big organisation. But we're going to have work started in earnest this year, and we will have a new hospital at some stage in the not too distant future. You know, I mean, let's hope it operates as well as it looks.
Peculiarly, the former MP for Kemp Town was trying to claim that as his personal triumph in the run-up to the general election.
I mean, I think in fairness to Simon Kirby, he put in a hell of a lot of work behind the scenes, lobbying the Department for Health and the Department of Health and the Treasury. He was Jeremy Hunt's PPS for a while, you know, and he brought him down to Brighton to the Sussex Beacon, the Royal Sussex and things like that. And I think the job of an MP is not one I'd like to do, but I think that the political tide in Brighton was against him.
Yes, I think so. Nevertheless... it's a development which will go on and on. I live round the corner from it. Let's see whether we can see.
And by the time it's finished, will it still be fit for purpose, or will we have moved on in terms of technology and need?
Well,
it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, tough question.
that's always a hard one to call, really. But I mean, we do have, as we speak, the Brexit negotiations going on. They grind on and on. And of course, we forget there are about 50,000, more than 50,000 EU nationals propping up the NHS service, none more so than in this neck of the woods. And many of them have no idea whether they are wanted and can remain.
I think whatever the different ministers say at different times about how welcome or not they are, I think the general message, whether you're a leaver or a remainer, I think it's clear that there is a sort of general message that's gone out that seems to be along the lines of you're not welcome here. And I think many leave. I think many people who voted leave actually would say, no, it's not true. We do want to, you know, we're not against necessarily immigration, or we're not against EU working with the EU. But of course, it's really hard when you go through a process like we're going through now to get some of those nuances out. And you know,
how do those people see that working?
I don't know. I mean, really, if we come out
of this extraordinary thing that we've been in for so many years,
you have a binary
and part
vote.
Of it is about migration. Yeah. How can you say, I want out, but we still want all those people to come in and do the jobs that, frankly, these are jobs that
either the really
British people
jobs,
will not want to do?
Well, they're either really expert jobs or the really low-level jobs, it seems.
And I think that, that really extends to elderly care. Even more importantly, that people will not do those jobs looking after older
and
people.
And also, we need to remember, this is still a local economy that has a sizable chunk of it dependent on the visitor economy. Mm. And if you look at the restaurants, the hotels, it's populated by people from the EU and beyond.
Yeah.
With my other hat on, you know, writing about food and drink and the leisure industries... the hotels, I mean, they won't have any staff. And one of the things is that a lot of the jobs within that industry are deemed to be inappropriate for English people to do. You know, how many people did you grow up with who said, oh, my career, I want to be a sommelier, I want to be a head waiter, I want to be a hotel manager? Nobody.
But one of the benefits that all these... overseas workers in the visitor economy have is they bring to the table a language facility which Brits simply don't have. And you know, when we look at the you know, the 11 or 12 million people who come to this city, many of them are day trippers, but many of them are not. And to be able to converse in your own language in a restaurant or a hotel with someone who is from your country, actually a lot of EU nationals speak, you know, two or three languages and put us to shame. We have a language deficit in this
totally.
Country.
I'm embarrassed that I speak only English and a fluent menu.
Frank, let's take another pause and tell listeners about your choice. This is your desert island.
Well, I'm going to go back to childhood. I mean, Andrew mentioned the possibility to go back to his teens. It was, yes, my early teens. Don't Stop Me Now by Queen, which is just a feel-good song, I think, and a year that sometimes seems a bit dismal. Let's have some cheering up.
I have to agree with you with that. So let's listen to this.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself.
Wow, that was a bit of a shaker there.
I have to tell all the listeners that these two were both dancing and together.
I know. Formation dancing relives in the
strictly.
Reverb studio. Let's just bring it back to some of the other issues that popped into my head when I was thinking about this programme. We've got universal credit that has been, proclaimed as the be-all and end-all of how to deal with... payments by the government, but the reality of it, I think, is completely opposite. So I keep coming across people who are being threatened or have been thrown out of their homes because their rents aren't being paid. And this goes back to something we touched on earlier, is about the austerity programme. So any thoughts about how austerity has continued to impact on the local economy here? We've got budgets coming up in the new year. Any thoughts, Sir Frank?
The universal credit idea, that all the payments rolled into one, I think it's got two things. One, it saves the government a lot of money in payments, you know, in terms of transaction costs, which is attractive to them. And also the other idea was that I think even the political opponents, the Tories, would say actually there are a lot of things about it they like, but they don't like the implementation. And even Ian Duncan Smith, the architect of the policy, says that there are things, you know, George Osborne, the former Chancellor and presumably a political rival within the party, underfunded it so that it wouldn't work as well as it should have done. And it, you know, when you've got someone who's perceived to be as right-wing as Ian Duncan Smith saying that, you've got to start scratching your head and saying, well, maybe they haven't got it right. And it does seem that there are critics within their own party as well as on the opposition benches, locally and nationally.
But I mean, we've had notice of motions in the local authority, local council, drawing attention to the inhumanity of the way this has been implemented, and the government sort of kind of listened at the last budget and reduced the the delay between applying
and put some more money in for to sort of what I call the hardship fund element, if you like. But I think that you're right. I spoke about the numbers, but it is on a human level, how you treat people and the most vulnerable in your own country, and how you look at people who are claiming benefits. Some people see them as a sort of just the cost that they are to the state, whereas others see them as people who are in a difficult time in their lives and need help. And of course, both sides of that, both ways of looking at it are true, but it's how you then balance those to give people a chance of contributing to the economy again and dignity in their lives.
Yeah, I think there are two things that we should look at here. I think we should look at the fact that we are a country which isn't that big, but actually the cost of living is so, so diverse from the south coast here, where we live in a very expensive city, to the north of England, where it's much cheaper to live. How can you have one cover-all policy for that? But really, what I would say is, why are we spending so much time worrying about these small amounts of money, which, in comparison to what I'm going to say, are tiny amounts compared to the amount of tax avoidance of major corporations in this country? For goodness sake, why isn't the government dealing with that?
It's not just major corporations. Well, it turns out to be a lot of well-heeled individuals who are offshoring their wealth.
As was released in the Panama Papers. Mm. I mean, it is extraordinary that we're putting so much emphasis on this small amount of money, comparatively small amount of money, for people who really need help, when these fat cats are sitting on offshore funds, massive amounts of
and
money.
And I understand that there were some high-level Treasury meetings with some of these people where, you know, people got sort of little feather dusters on the back of their hands and told to be,
you've been a very, very naughty boy.
You've been very naughty, but no impact. But you compare that with the treatment of people who are deemed to be benefit cheats and
yes.
the amount of money
and it's tiny.
Spent on...
It's a tiny amount of money.
It just seems...
disproportionate.
Disproportionate.
Yes. Yeah. It's not unlike the story about the people behind the charity single those years ago who were out with their begging bowl, and actually they revealed how much money these people have in offshore investments, you know, including shopping malls in countries that they didn't even know that they owned.
I bought a shopping mall, but I didn't realise.
Yeah. In the street with no name.
Let's just move this, because this is a kind of a consequence of a Conservative Party policy which has been pursued cack-handedly, I guess. I remain to be convinced that it's got any merits to it at the moment, but let's be persuaded.
I think giving people a single payment is a widely accepted good idea. I think paying their rent to them to pay onto their landlords, when you're often dealing with people who have chaotic finances and chaotic lives, is a less good idea.
Exactly.
And there are many other criticisms of,
Well, it was a time where your dole check would be. For the rent element would be paid direct to the landlord. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't have to worry about a roof over your head. But let's just talk about locally. We've got this 2017 saw the stepping down of long-term leader of the local Conservative group, Geoffrey Theobald, and the rise of a slightly surprising leader, Tony Janio, who is, I think, quite an interesting character. Dr. Tony Janio, I should say. What's your thoughts, Sir Frank?
Well, first of all, I mean, Geoffrey, whatever your party politics, I think Geoffrey has served Brighton and latterly Brighton and Hove over many, many years, and East Sussex as well, when the county council was, we were part of the county council area. And people have disagreed with him fiercely at times, but he's generally been a very decent and sort of... okay fellow in many people's eyes. And I think he went with some warmth from even some of his political opponents. I was going to look to try and see if you were glad to see the back of him, but
I'm clearly watching Geoffrey's face here to see what his reaction is.
I used to find him quite honourable, because you knew where they were coming from, the
yes.
Tories. And it wasn't their modus operandi to oppose just for the sake of opposing. They recognised that they weren't the largest party, and therefore they were constructive.
No, indeed, I've always found him very, very, very decent and very courteous.
I used to get slightly amused when there was a sort of a mode. You can just see him explode, and Geoffrey Theobald exploding in full council would be a
always
a
very entertaining.
A sight that I shall miss.
Well, Tony explains in different ways, but I've noticed he's saying a lot less at the start of his speeches. I wasn't going to say anything this evening.
However, yes, that always seemed to be his modus operandi. Plus, I'm rather fond of Tony. He's a bit of a wind-up merchant.
Yes, he is.
And he would deliberately wind up some of my ex-Green Party colleagues by wearing his Ronald Reagan ties or his ballistic missile ties.
I know people don't sort of necessarily, unless you sort of watch the council close up for a long time, you don't realise, A, how much boredom people must have to put up with being a councillor, because a lot of the meetings are extraordinarily tedious. But nonetheless, they're attending to lots of very important details in the administration of the city.
Yeah.
But someone like Tony as well brings a bit of fun to it, I have to say. He's got a sense of humour. He can see the ridiculousness of the situation at times and is happy to go along and play with that, you know. But he still gets the serious business done, as far as I can see. He knows.
But he's an interesting choice because one of the other aspects of the year has been the virtual takeover of the local Labour Party by Momentum, who are the flag bearers for Jeremy Corbyn's view of how the Labour Party should be. And we've just had a recent meeting where they had a clean sweep in the committee that decides on who are going to be the candidates for the local elections. And I wonder whether some well-established councillors might be looking over the shoulder, worrying whether they're going to be readopted for the next local elections.
Well, my sense is that some of them have sort of shifted their positioning, if you like, within the party slightly, and in terms of their public pronouncements and their allegiances.
Enabled to be reselected.
Yes. But I'm not surprised in that, because I think some people say, well, it's just their ambition or just they want to keep their seats, and maybe that is the case. But also, many people don't have a hard, single, fixed view of everything, and actually are persuadable on a number of issues. There might be one or two things you feel very strongly about. But I get the sense that you're watching the way deals are brokered at the council sometimes, that many people are, have got a few entrenched positions, but a lot of the time they're persuadable on a broad number of issues. So that doesn't surprise me. There are a few people who are very fixed in the Labour Party, and that's where you'll see the polarity and the fight coming. And, the numbers look like it's going to go one way, but again, you wouldn't write off someone like Peter Carr, for example, who's not an arch Corbynite.
Well, we're looking ahead now to the adoption of candidates for the next locals.
Yes.
I suspect that the government will try and cling on to the bitter end for the full five-year term, because many of the Theresa May's parliamentary candidates don't want a general election any time soon, because the prospect of a Jeremy Corbyn-led government is a real prospect for them. So the first hurdle for the local Labour Party is getting their candidates in place. And people like Warren, who've already had some open challenges to his supremacy as leader, may be wondering whether they will succeed in getting readopted next year.
I don't sense Warren Morgan has shifted his position at all. He has been one of those people who has sort of remained fairly, this is who I am, this is what I believe. And it will almost certainly cost him the leadership, possibly next spring, maybe after that, but I suspect next April. He may even no longer be leader of the council and the Labour group. Let's see.
I think the real problem here is that actually for a great many people who have a vote, they don't actually really know how a local council functions, how it works. And you talk about tedious meetings and things like that. Well, frankly, if you stand for election, then you must be prepared that some of it will not be ripping and exciting. But I think we need to educate the public on what exactly the council's remit is, how it works and what it does. And it's not just councillors, but it's also the officers of the council. And I don't think many people understand the structure between the elected councillors and the officers in those offices and what they actually do. Is one the machine and one the oil? And which is which?
Well, I've got a view on that, but I'm the presenter, so...
I often feel that actually what should be the oil that makes the council work is actually thinking that it's the machine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things we can look forward to in 2018, I'm assuming, is a by-election in East Brighton. We have the odd situation where the sitting MP in Kent Town is Lloyd Russell Moyle, who is also a member for East Brighton, which is the same ward as Warren Morcombe and the deputy leader, Councillor Jill Mitchell. I suspect it'll be another shoo-in for the Labour Party. And again, another Corbynista.
I made such bad predictions at the general election that
I'm
willing to.
I didn't want to remind you.
I haven't forgotten. So I'm willing to make another bad one now. I think that I don't often make predictions, but I suspect Nancy Platts may be selected, and I suspect she may win the seat. And I suspect she may well be the next leader of the Labour Council in Brighton.
Well, it could be. I think actually, putting all party allegiances aside, I think she's a very good egg. Hmm. And of course, she's worked for Jeremy Corbyn as the liaison with the trade union movement.
There are other good candidates on the council who could take over if Warren Morgan is ousted, like Dan Yates, for example. But I think, you know, you can almost see a path being prepared for Nancy to be both elected to the council and become leader shortly afterwards, and so it wouldn't surprise me at all. I'm bound to be totally wrong.
I just wish that we could actually vote for the quality of a human being and not for a party allegiance.
Indeed.
And I think that's really sad. And I've found over the last few years, coming from the north of England, I probably always felt that I was a socialist and Labour voter, actually feeling that I don't actually always want to vote for that person because that's the party that historically I would have voted for. But I want to vote for the person who I think is the best person for the job. And that's why I've shifted my vote in the last few years.
I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to tie this really interesting conversation. I'm going to ask last thoughts. What do you think is going to be the highlight for 2018, Andrew?
I don't think I'm seeing a highlight at the moment. I'm very concerned about coming out of Europe, and I think it's going to be tragic, and I think we all need to be looking to make the best of what we have left from that.
Correct. I think the note of gaiety for the nation will be the royal wedding next year.
The royal wedding?
Yes. I know some of us will sigh with despair.
Yeah,
I'm going to
book a holiday when that's on.
I think it will cheer a lot of people up, regardless, as the last one did.
Yes, and let's hope no taxpayers' money is spent on the wedding.
The Politics Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
And on that note, a sour note from me, I'm afraid. We wish you all a very, very happy Christmas and a bright new year from Radio Reverb's Politics Show. Thank you for listening.